The topic that we're discussing today is baby boomers and the Christian faith. And my name is Steve Hitchcock. I work for a fundraising firm with offices in Berkeley, California, and Washington, D.C. There are about 124 people in the firm, and we work for a variety of clients. And I have both client responsibilities and administrative responsibilities, which mostly means I don't get my work done during the day, and that there's always someone who has a complaint about something. I enjoy that work. It brings me into contact with a wide diversity of people, and perhaps we'll talk a little bit more about that. Another part or facet of my life that is involved with an organization called New Models for Ministry, which is a group of folks in the Bay Area who are focused on encouraging people in their ministries in everyday life. We've tried, and I think successfully, to go beyond the discussion of lay versus clergy and to say that there are issues of ministry that all of us have, whether we're lay or clergy, issues of ministry that occur outside of the walls of the institutional church. And this time I got my act together and remembered to bring some copies of our newsletter. And also, if you'd like to receive this newsletter without obligation, I'd be glad to add your name to your mailing list. So I'll pass this around with a pen. So I'll just give those to you. Well, that's who I am, and that's the topic. Let's get to it. There's a saying that the best sermon is the sermon that you preach for yourself. And this is, of all the sessions that I've prepared for Holden, has been one of the most exciting. Because really, I'm describing myself. And we're talking about ourselves, for the most part. And those of us who aren't baby boomers, we're talking about a segment of population that impacts all of our lives. You're still being recharged, Signa?
I'm sorry.
You're still being recharged?
Yes, it is.
Okay.
Yeah. I hope. I think.
Let's see.
Things like this waste your time.
No, that's fine. It's not a waste.
Thank you.
This amplifies for Signa. One of the reasons that Elmer Witt asked me to be here, and one of the reasons that I'm glad to be here and talk about a larger theme of ministry of the laity, is that I think the institutional church and certainly the Lutheran Church is in a crisis situation. And it is, from a business standpoint, which is my experience in life, a declining business, if you will. It is a market that is declining. And the statistics prove that, the finances prove that, the pattern of organizational development. There are lots of different ways of looking at it from an organizational or business perspective. It's a declining business. The tragic part is it's also one of the vehicles through which the good news of Jesus Christ gets proclaimed in our world. My own personal experience is that that's good news that the world desperately needs. The challenge then, I think, or the opportunity, if you will, for us as laypersons is to be the vehicle of good news, to be the agents of redemption and renewal in our society. The rub is how we get nurtured for that, and I hope that some of what we talk about today will help us discover how we are nourished for that kind of ministry in the world. If Christ is the memory for our future, which is the term, baby boomers are the future. And Elmer's description of the shift in consciousness in his Sunday evening Eucharist sermon makes this even more challenging. The shift from people who are time-oriented, as those of us who still identify with our parents' values, to those of us who are space-oriented, people who are not preoccupied with time and guilt, but who are preoccupied with emptiness and loneliness in filling the spaces in their lives. So I think it's helpful to talk about baby boomers. Who are they? I'd like to do four things. I'd like to describe baby boomers. I'd like to take a look at the lifestyle of baby boomers. I'd like to talk about the values of baby boomers. And finally, I'd like to talk about what the Christian faith has to do with that. So that the last one doesn't get short shrift, let's see if we can't go quickly through the first three. Let me just put down seven things here. Thought I had other notes, but that I didn't pass my notes out to you, did I? This is good. I'll have to wing it. Okay. 1946 to 1964. After post-World War II, 76 million Americans were born during this period of time. The peak, and the reason it's called a boom is you can see it, 1957 was the peak with 4.3 million births in just 1 year. So that means that what? You're either, if you're a baby boomer, how old are you? 23 to 41 years old. There are 6.3 million more women than men in that period, and it's increasing because men die faster than women. The prediction is that at one point in this baby boom span, there may be as many as 7 million more women than men. 51% of all dual income families are boomers. Which is pretty startling when you think now more than half of all married women are working. And why is this low?
Because childbirth.
The figure is actually larger. Why would the figure actually be the reality of dual income families is actually larger? Because of people who are living together who are not married. And in most cases, those people who are living together are dual income families. 54% of boomers have college education or college degrees. What's the percentage? It's 50% plus work in managerial class, if you will, or managerial jobs. Okay. That gives you an idea of who we are and some of the characteristics that we have. Let's talk a little bit about the lifestyle. And in order to understand that, let's go back. And what will be fun is that many of us in this room grew up as children who were born during that period. In fact, I think most of us did. Yeah, Rich.
I just ask a maybe obvious question. What's the reason for this happening? Is there an obvious explanation?
Why are there baby boomers?
Why did we hit this major crest, this major peak at this point in history?
Okay. Why did we? Anyone know? I mean,
World War II.
Okay. And what happened before World War II?
Depression.
Depression. So you had two forces with tremendous pent-up demand for family creation, for marriage and family.
You mean that all the pressure was off? And
mm-hmm.
Everything was just go, go, go.
Go, go, go. The GI Bill, which enabled, this was the first generation, parents were the first generation to have the GI Bill available for them. The economic renewal or renaissance that occurred as a result of the Second World War and the rebuilding of Europe, all of those fueled that. There's some reasons why it started to decline, obviously because that group got older and you can only have so many children before your childbearing years are over. There are other historical forces that I don't know as much about as the present reality. Well, let's go back and try to remember what was the experience of childhood for those of us who are baby boomers. Let's try to describe that. Well, how did we grow up? What did we grow up with?
Television.
What else? Where did we grow up?
Cities.
Suburbs. And we grew up, 70% of us, 70% of our parents owned their own homes, which will be important as we talk later. Think about immigrants spending time in tenements, people spending time either owning farms, which is different from a home, or working on farms, which most of them really did. 70% owned homes. What else?
We love toys.
Toys. What that really represented was a delayed adolescence. When you didn't go to work in the factory, you didn't go to work on the farm, you had time to play with toys.
Two automobiles.
Two automobiles. Very interesting. Anything else? Shaped our...
Public school.
And the fact that our generation, more than others, were able to go clear through high school and college, where the most poor parents were needed.
College education, although that wasn't part of our childhood. In a sense, it was part of our childhood, because it was one of the, that was where your childhood was supposed to end up. Anything else that we grew up with? Yeah?
Is there an increased interest in recreational kinds of activities?
Yep.
Everybody exiting the city on weekends to the lake?
Vacations. Weekends.
Travel trailers.
Travel trailers.
Technology.
In one sense, that's true. In another sense, it's not true. It's certainly, I think, our children are more having the experience of technological change, at least in the last several decades.
We have the technology of modern kitchen.
Okay.
Indoor bathroom. Increased import-export products.
Okay. The word that Galbraith used for that, Kenneth Galbraith, was affluence, etc.
Well, and really what sums up all those things were that we had everything we wanted and needed.
Yes. some other things that I think, I remember growing up, and even now, the there's two movies that for me typify it. Beach Blanket. What's it?
Bingo.
Bingo. Forget the other. And the James Bond films. But part of what that is, what for me anyway, as a child growing up, is the tremendous focus on the sexuality of both of our entire generation. Our generation, more than the predecessors, focused on sex. And I guess one other way to call that is pleasure. We had that experience. Anything else that you remember from growing up? Was during those lovely 50s and 60s?
Well, there was a lack of extended family for me and moving.
Okay.
Which is really, yeah, you weren't living in the same town.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Some presidential assassination.
Okay. The assassinations. Some of us were adults already, but some of us were still children. I remember in junior high school. And the other one, again, some of us were adults, but some of us were still children.
Early in the 50s and maybe even in the 60s, most mothers were not working.
Okay. Mom was home. Fascinating list to see why, where we are. Now, let's talk about where we are now.
Shouldn't you mention the drug culture?
Yeah, I think that, at least I see that, Signe, as part of this, sex, pleasure, and drugs. That's a very good connection, though.
Okay.
What's the other word that we, other group that we think of when we think of baby boomers that are, that's often associated with baby boomers?
Hippies.
Hippies? Yep. Now, yuppies. Yuppies, interestingly enough, which are upwardly, what is it, young, upwardly,
urban
professionals, etc., represent only 3 to 4% of the group. Most of us don't want to be yuppies, and most of us probably aren't yuppies. Yes. What was the lumps was the great one that I heard just recently. Have you ever heard of lumps? Life-giving, unselfish, middle-class parents. Survivors. But without generalizing too much for the yuppies, let's try to describe the lifestyle of those persons who were born between 1946 and 1964. How are they living now? Let's just say a few things about that. There's always a lot to say. The most important thing about baby boomers, from my perspective and my reading of the literature, is that our lives are focused on work. The typical work day for a baby boomer is 60 to 70 hours per week. And later in the week, I hope to talk about the whole shape of work in modern America and what that means for our Christian faith. The shifts in the way in which we work, the way in which we make our livings, and the values we associate with that have undergone revolutionary change just in the last couple decades. Certainly that change has roots that's much further back. But for now, let's just say that our lives are focused on work. Not only our own life as an individual, but our family life, because there are both people who are working, often both working those 60 to 70 hours per week. Primarily, the reason that that is happening is not because of women's liberation, but because of the economic reality. Most of us earn, when you adjust for inflation, less than our parents do. And 70% of us, remember, grew up in homes of our own. The only way you can own a home today is if you both work, with some exceptions. So you have people who are spending their lives in work. The families are small. By 1990, simply because of the demographics that now exist, the typical American family, the average family, will be three persons. So that means, in most cases, husband, wife, and one child. The third thing is that the focus is not on the family as a unit, however, even though there are still lots of families and lots of families being formed, but the focus is on the individual as the basic unit of our society. Again, that doesn't mean that families don't exist, but the way in which we perceive our society and perceive our activity in it is. Think of it. Personal computers. Individual servings. Go to the grocery store today. It's incredible the number of individual servings. I just noticed that we got yogurt. Yogurt now comes in four little individual servings. Housing, the way in which houses are being built today, are for the individual unit. And we live in the Bay Area, and houses are built with two master bedroom suites. That means that people, individuals, are buying houses together, but living as individuals within a house. Are there some other lifestyle? Those are the three that I've focused on. We're all together in this.
Divorce.
Actually, I think what's more phenomenal is really the experience of marriage as temporary. Or marriage as delayed. One of the reasons that families are getting smaller is why?
Later.
Right. One of the reasons that divorce rates are declining is why?
Not getting married.
The other reason is that people are marrying later. The statistical probability of divorce declines the older you are when you get married. Any other lifestyle? Yeah.
My interpretation, number one, is that focus is more on materialism and possessions than on work, and work is simply the means to get there. My hunch is if you ask those people, if you had everything you wanted without having to work, would you work?
Mm-hmm.
I think many of them would say, no, I'd play. So I think there's a sense of being imprisoned by materialism.
Okay. There is an interesting dimension of that. I think many of us think of ourselves or our generation as being consumers and focusing on possessions. But there is a dynamic of that that I think reflects a declining standard of living. What is it about the possessions that we buy? Pardon?
They don't last long.
They do last long, or they don't. I think that they do last longer. You know, I think we want them to anyway.
Yeah, but we're selling cars at 50,000 miles. Many of them are not ready. Some of them won't last any longer than that. Many of them are just being broken in.
Uh-huh.
People seem to think that there's a limited lifespan of things you buy.
But I think we have changed that. I think our generation, I think at least from a marketing perspective, which I know because of my business experience, there is this shift. Look at what Chrysler is now offering. Is it 70? Is it 7 years and 70,000 now? It was 5 years and 50,000, and they've increased it again. Why do people buy BMWs, buy Mercedes? It's not just because it's a status symbol. There is that search for quality. People are buying CDs because they last longer, etc. There is that search for a high quality product.
Quality doesn't necessarily mean that you can have it for longer periods of time. It means that, that it works better here mm-hmm. and now.
That's true.
They may trade it in 2 years.
That's true.
Yeah, I wouldn't agree with the search for high quality. You buy a BMW because not very many people can.
Mm-hmm.
You buy a CD because not that many people have CDs. You're just not going to settle for stereo anymore.
Why do we buy the most? Why is...
Because we want the best.
We want the best. Maybe that's the best way to put it.
That's the materialism trend.
That's true.
The 770 is just a marketing come on to buy mm-hmm. garbage. The quality didn't change. They're just selling you down the road on something because I know you won't keep it that long anyway.
Right.
You'll dump it before they have to mm-hmm. fix it.
Mm-hmm.
And then the second guy gets stuck with it breaking down. So I don't think the quality's changed. I think just the marketing come on has convinced us that it's maybe there on the business.
Mm-hmm. And that we'll pay $6 or $7 for a gallon of ice cream. I don't remember that in my growing up experience, my family saying, gee, what's the most expensive ice cream that we can buy? Mike, you know, let's go in and find the cheapest ice cream and buy it. Or that the chocolate has to be exquisitely pure.
See, that's a measure of success that you tend to want to prove to yourself by what you can obtain or possess.
Mm-hmm. I think that that's true. Well, that's true. Well, without making any more value judgments, let's try to, which I think we need to do. I want to spend time doing that. What are some of the other characteristics or lifestyle descriptive
Something we already mentioned is that most of us now are college graduates.
Okay. What does that mean for our lifestyle, though?
I think it sort of blends into the first thing that your life is focused on work.
Okay.
Because college is supposedly, you know, to say, to prepare you for work in a successful job and all that.
I think it means that we spend time reading. We involved in cultural activities. My parents felt that Lawrence Welk was concert music. Now, that's not to denigrate Lawrence Welk, but that's not what college graduates go do. College graduates go and get symphony tickets or repertory tickets.
No.
No.
Yeah.
I think that causes us to set different expectations for our children's education, too.
Mm-hmm.
That high school graduate maybe isn't enough now.
Okay. That's very true.
I think we have an emphasis on health and fitness.
Good.
Yeah. Urban and out of the house.
Pardon?
Urban and out of the house.
Say more. I don't.
Well, we live in. We don't. There are no. No, I would say that a good number of us are trying to avoid the suburbs.
Mm-hmm.
And there are no more housewives anymore.
Okay, no housewives.
Well, fewer and fewer.
That's very true, though. Again, the statistical probability is that probably only 1 in 5 households will ever have a house, in that old sense of having a housewife. Any other lifestyle thing? Yeah.
I think there's some change from what used to be modes of transportation to becoming toys, like cars.
Mm-hmm.
They used to be necessities, now they're toys.
Mm-hmm.
Or horses. Or, you know, we're converting lots of things that used to be needed just to get to work or to get to different places into playthings.
Okay. Necessities become toys.
Toys become necessities.
Okay. I'll put an arrow with both ways. Okay. Well, some of this gets into the value. Obviously, with Rich's help, we're value laden here. So why don't we try to talk a little bit more about what those are. Let me just say two things, maybe as an introduction. One is, I think that this is the reality that the church has to deal with. The 76 million people are the predominant life-shaping, value-shaping element in our society. And we have, I think, a necessity to understand, to empathize, and to explore this segment of the population. Also, the second thing I wanted to say is that we know a lot about this group for two reasons. What two reasons are those? Why have we been surveyed? Why have we been tested? Why have we been random sampled to death? What's at stake here?
They're consumers.
Right. Advertisers, the big advertising agencies have done thousands and thousands of in-depth studies of our behavior, our beliefs, our attitudes, etc. The other thing that's at stake? A former political candidate knew it was at stake. Gary Hart and Pat Caddell and some of the other people who were at one time associated with Hart and others. The political landscape is at stake. And again, there has been because of that, there's been a lot of exploration of what baby boomers want out of life and what they believe. Well, what are the, given our childhood experience, given the demographic realities, given our lifestyle, what are some of our values? And try to be empathetic, not just with your own church-based values. I'm assuming that most of us have those. What are the values? Because we're immersed in this culture. As much as we try to remove ourselves, we are still on the same continuum with those folks. What are our values? What were we taught?
Pleasure.
There's 76 million of us. What did we learn? Competition. If you're going to get into college, you're competing against, that's what I learned. My parents didn't drill that into me, but when you go to a high school with 3,000 kids and when you live in the Bay Area with all these other people that want to live there, and they're willing to take $2,000 less than you to live in the Bay Area, you've got to be competitive.
I think another one is something about the system. Trying to formulate my thoughts, maybe the system isn't always right. That's what I want to say. I don't know how to say it.
Okay. Herschel Gordon Lewis, one of the famous advertisers or copywriters of the day calls it, this is the age of skepticism. It's not just authority that we question. It's not just the system, it's both and more. What are our other values? Yeah.
Individualism and self-decisiveness?
Yes. Individualism. Positive way, self-reliance. Partly because of what you said about mobility. When mom and dad are 10,000 miles or 2,000 miles away, you're on your own. I went off to school in Indiana. My parents, at age 18, my parents were more than 1,000 miles. I had to become self-reliant. I was individual. I think related to this, too, Rich, is the drive towards personal success, that the measure of the person is the success that that person achieves. What else?
I heard once that our parents were taught when they grew up to, or that we were taught to show respect, and what mm-hmm. we're teaching our kids is to be independent.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know where that fits in here, if it's a blend of both. In terms mm-hmm. of values, the values shift. Respect isn't enough. We need to it's mm-hmm. the self-reliance that you're
okay.
talking about.
Independence is a good word, though. Yeah.
I'm not a baby boomer, but I have had baby boomers.
Yes, you have.
And I think idealism or the wish for to serve, compassion, however.
That's very true. Mm-hmm. The 60s were fueled by that idealism and compassion.
Something about self-worth.
Okay.
I don't know what the right word is. There seems to be a lot more, you know, about liking yourself more than when you mm-hmm. grew up. It's okay to talk about that and say you're okay and that you
yeah.
like yourself.
It's okay to talk about self-worth, which is different from, I think, what our parents grew up with. The self-worth industry in the United States is now $3 billion. That's a pretty big item.
Which means we must not have much of it.
It's no longer assumed. It's no longer part of growing up in the Hitchcock family in Moberly, Missouri, doesn't give you your position in society. Because you're not in Moberly, Missouri, and the Hitchcock family, nobody knows from Adam. You have to make your own self-worth. It's not given to you in our society. Other values?
I don't know where it fits in there, and mm-hmm. it's not necessarily bad, but power.
Okay.
I want to say it's a value in terms of why we look at competition or the self-reliance or idealism or that's kind of the base.
Mm-hmm.
It can be the base. And it's not necessarily bad.
No. I don't, frankly, to be honest with you, I don't think anything of these things are bad. I mean, pleasure is not a bad idea. I'm not sure that the sexual inhibitions of our parents and grandparents were always helpful. that authority does need to be questioned. But okay, power. I think a related value to that, and what you're the experience of this generation or this time, the decline of political parties, the decline of union membership, even the decline of religious beliefs, I think means that we are a relentlessly non-ideological group. Steve DeGrucci and I were talking about how hard it is to communicate the church experience in the United States, where it's very important that you have that you're religious. But a curse on you if you're religious, if you impose your particular religious system on someone else. And the real question, the Gary Hart campaign and the search in the Democrats right now is on what works. I don't know about your own job experience, but this is the question that gets asked in the environment that I'm in every day. Not, does this contribute to American patriotism? Does this contribute to the enlargement or the enhancement of the American family? Is this compassionate? What works? Yeah.
The form of that, what sells?
I think what sells is really a form of this. The other positive way to say that is that we're very pragmatic. What other values that you can think of?
Is, I don't know if this is a value, joining groups or joining organizations, be it an investment group, be it the YMCA and doing things with people in there, or a health club, and joining groups.
Groups.
High touch.
Yep. The other way to say that is that we're a participation group.
That's sort of the other side of the coin from number four, individualism.
Yes.
It's the consequence of it being individualistic.
Yes. Isn't that amazing that you, if you, I've done this a couple times with other groups, and when you start to trot out these values, you see the paradox, the irony, the ambiguity of the baby boom generation. And that's, for me anyway, that the challenge to Christian faith is to live in that kind of paradox. You have this incredible sense of individualism and self-reliance, the questioning of authority and skepticism, and yet this search for ideals, this search for compassion, for transcendence. Certainly some of the cults typify the downside of that in our generation.
It also seems to be sort of opposite to what seems to be an inward, maybe it's just materialism. You know, instead mm-hmm. of going to a community pool, you want your own pool in the backyard.
Yes.
Instead of going to movie theater, you want your VCR.
CR.
I'm still odd whenever I go into homes that are in a totally secure area, you know,
yes, with the fences around there, the guards.
It makes sense, you know, especially for, you know, the homes I've been in, there's a lot to steal.
Yes, I think that that's exactly the case. Yeah. Yes?
I think with power, maybe, would go the financial security or wealth.
Mm-hmm.
And control.
Pardon?
Control.
I just can't imagine, I mean, in the early 50s, a television program called The Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous. That just, but that is that sort of, who are the movers, shakers, and controllers?
But isn't that the other side of all these things, is that you have to make your own meaning, but that also means that you're probably going to be struggling with doubt. And your mm-hmm. culture gave us meanings before. Almost
yes.
all of those things.
Yes.
Now it's individually.
Yes.
Or not you.
Right. And not only is there doubt, which I think is part of we were educated to be, most of us were educated to be doubters. But there are also, I think, some important forces outside of our own inner intelligence and inner beings that make all of these values conditional, that undercut all of these values. Just name a few of them. I refuse to believe that AIDS is somehow a punishment for promiscuity or for our lifestyle, but it certainly raises the question about whether or not the pursuit of pleasure is possible. In a competitive society, the fascinating thing, and I guess I've spent enough time and I've watched enough businesses, that competition is ultimately destructive. Somehow there has to be cooperation, and I see it in with the 50 people that I work with. You know, we all have our own clients and we all want our clients to succeed. But ultimately the business succeeds only if we cooperate. And those organizations that are successful these days are able to build up a cooperative structure.
Steve, the other item there probably is the nuclear arms race.
Yeah.
The worldwide competition.
Yeah. The end of the competition is literally the mushroom cloud. Yeah. Some, I'm sorry, did I end?
I mean, when you said cooperation, you mean within the company or companies need to cooperate with each other?
Well, also companies need to cooperate with each other. Now the rhetoric of that is that that's monopoly, but I don't think that's the case. I have a great friend who owns a steel fabrication business, and his view is that he hates this word. He says, I have a market niche and someone else has another one. We have to cooperate to find out which market niches or niches we want to each fill.
I have a friend who is running a machine, owns a machine shop, and his theory is that all the competition going on at his level is destroying their kind of business because foreign competition is cooperating and moving in and taking away all the business that we're fighting over.
That's correct. Yeah. We see it on a very personal level too, that ultimately competition undercuts our ability to make a livelihood. Well, we can talk about more about that. Well, the individualism, the self-reliance, independence, this drive towards personal success. The reality is that 76 million of us can't all be a success. There just isn't enough money, enough goodies, enough toys out there for everyone to be a personal success. This business of self-worth, identity, this business of search, the inner journey, and maybe you've had more experience in that than I have, Rich. But certainly you run into people who have made that search. And when you make the inward journey, you find some things inside that aren't so pleasant. That the focus on the self raises both negative and positive. Certainly power and wealth have been destructive. The pragmatism is an issue that I think of a value that has been undercut in many ways. The problem, and some of you may be involved in corporations that are now obsessed. The irony is that successful organizations and successful companies are finding out that what works is not pragmatism, but culture or values. That when standards of compassion, when ideals, etc., are lived out, that is what works. And the relentless pursuit of the bottom line of a financial profitability, again, is counterproductive. Well, the other value I think that is undercut, ironically, again, is the issue of participation. And for me, looking at all of these, that is the fundamental contradiction of the baby boomer generation. This tremendous focus on self-reliance and this need to participate. Here at Holding the World Word is called community. And I understand there was some discussion about commitment and friendship and overcoming loneliness. We desperately want to have relationships. We desperately want to be part of community, but we can't seem to get out of this box of self-reliance. Anything else on that? Well, I don't think I have all the answers, but what I thought we could do is spend a few minutes on whether or not we can, as baby boomers, take a second look at our Christian faith and see whether it helps us as we try to struggle with some of these values.
Yeah, see, one of the things we can talk about on that sheet there that's now gone is the influence of all that on our kids.
That's a good point. I hadn't thought about that.
If we were brought up with lots of toys,
and
we expect to have toys as adults, and we're going out getting our VCRs, I see in our own kids this incredible drive toward collecting not just a lot of stuff, but absolutely the most expensive stuff. And the perfect example are those silly jeans.
Yeah.
You don't want the ones that fit the best. You go look at price tags. And you pick out the ones that are absolutely the most expensive.
Yeah, I mean,
their friends have you know, their families with five televisions in a household. And three VCRs. All going at once. And I think, well, I can see in our kids that already this incredible dismay and terror that it's not working.
Yeah, I think that's I hadn't thought about that a great deal, to be honest, the impact on our children. I do know that Lester Thoreau and some of the other economists look at it from a straight economical perspective, in that what we're giving our children is an incredible deficit. They look at it the way in which the use of credit in American culture, which is very, very hot, again, which is a baby boomer phenomenon. Our parents didn't do that. The other thing that is happening is that we're not paying for our children's educations. Children now are graduating with an average of $22,000 in educational debt. In a sense, we're saying to our children, yes, get it all now. I'm going to take care of myself, and you're going to have to take care of yourself. This business of you have to make your own meaning, I don't have any to leave to you. Well, let's take a few minutes and say, okay, what are there some resources in our Christian faith that can help us as baby boomers, that can be resources for our lives today? Are there some that come to your mind? I did some thinking about this. That's my job. I think we have some good answers to the identity self-worth issue. And without sounding too trite, it's not something that we have to earn or that we have to make, but that it's a given. That's part of the Christian tradition, that we come with the gift of our identity. The self-worth issue is solved. most poignantly in baptism, but it's certainly there. Another thing that I think that we offer is this concept of servant, and certainly Holden does that quite well. What I call it is relentless, unrelenting demotion. That somehow putting someone else in front of you is our calling in life. I think that we have to offer ourselves as baby boomers and other baby boomers is failure at an early age. The Christ story is really, I think, about failure, about getting yourself in a situation at which you're guaranteed to fail, you're guaranteed an early death. I haven't figured out how to make that connection with my own life, but certainly for those of us who have received the message that personal success at almost any cost is the goal of life, I think the Christ story of failure and then resurrection offers some clues that might be valuable.
Perhaps another way of looking at this is that Christianity enables you to redefine what is really meant by success.
Mm-hmm.
You said previously that you're hunting for success, but the facts of life are such that only a few are going
right.
to be able to change. Now, that's true.
Mm-hmm.
If you define success in terms of being at the top of certain ladders and having a certain amount of possessions.
Mm-hmm.
But you can define success. And I think Christianity attempts to define success
mm-hmm.
in such a way that it is achievable by everybody. Now, it seems to me that that's one of the important things that Christianity
yeah.
offers here.
Yeah, I think that that's true. That it does offer a different concept of success. It's something that's given. It involves service to others. And that involves suffering. I think the fourth and final thing, and then we'll go to dinner, is that what we have to offer baby boomers is long-term insecurity. But the corollary, to my mind, is short-term certainty. Luther and Melanchthon and the other reformers thought a lot over these two words, and I think that they're still helpful, that there isn't any security. And as we take a look at the shift in the workplace, tremendous competition that is undercutting any possibility of security. There are no secure jobs anymore. There are no more secure neighborhoods. And the biblical message is, gee, that's nothing new. Life is insecure. But there is certainly short-term in the sense of it's right here now available to all of us for the asking, the certainty that comes with identification with this Jesus who fails and suffers. That somehow through faith we are given the certainty of our identity, the certainty of our vocation, that I think is something that, at least for me, as a baby boomer, is a source of joy and confidence. Well, it's time to go eat dinner. As always, I learned more from you, and I thank you for that.